Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And today, another chapter, actually an underground chamber of the cultures of consciousness, as we'll be talking about charnel grounds, ossuaries, and the collections of bones, the bones that we will all be. One of the most famous sites for ossuaries that you tourists go to, it's a famous one in Czechoslovakia that we'll be talking about with our guest, Paul Kudamaris, in just a bit. Another one is, of course, the famous catacombs in Gay Paris. And I had been to the official tourist catacombs, which are very beautiful. They're lovely arrangements of bones and kind of these sort of architecture, sculptural, deeply patterned collections, very carefully done. But the last time I was in Paris, I had the opportunity to go to see the sort of other side of the catacombs, the illicit side of the catacombs. And it was a ridiculous, long, marvelous, crazy, drunken night that, you know, began with a whole group of us being led by somewhat shadowy figures who by the middle of the evening proved to be completely unreliable because they were inebriated to the point of catatonia, so which produced its own interesting experiences. But we were barely, 5 minutes into the catacombs proper, this immense labyrinth of underground chambers and passageways, largely under the southern part of the city where they had mined a lot of the limestone that built the city and used them for a variety of purposes, including storing bones, and the Nazis used them, and decadent fops used them, and these days there's a whole sort of, or has been for many years, a whole subculture of kind of spelunkers and explorers and mappers of the space. So we're there 5 minutes down the chamber, and some kid goes by with a backpack from a rival crew, and then let off a bunch of smoke bombs. So we were completely disoriented for about 20 minutes. And that was just the beginning. But the end of the evening is the reason that I'm bringing this up now. So we didn't see any bone rooms along the way. We saw a lot of amazing places and graffiti, and by the end of the evening we'd been hiking for miles, sometimes through mud and water, and we were exhausted and in my case profoundly intoxicated, and then we were encouraged to climb through this weird little hole in the side of the wall. Like, it didn't even really look like a passageway, and you had to kind of pop up and you couldn't see into the place, and you just kind of threw yourself into this chamber, and then we land in this chamber, and then bam, we're just like right on the just residue, the sort of broken remains of hundreds of thousands human beings. They weren't that large, but it was extremely bizarre to be like not just looking at these bones, but on them, because they weren't arranged. They weren't skulls and femurs. They were just like broken shin bones and crazy things. But the proximity to human bones, especially when they're, many, many of them, and when they're taken out of their skeletal form, is an extraordinary experience. It's profoundly moving. It's beautiful. It's disturbing. It's fascinating. It's mystical. And it was a very, very extraordinary way to end that evening. So I'm very happy to be talking to Paul today about his new book, Empire de la Mort, which is an extraordinary photographic journey through many, many charnel houses, including many that are very obscure, so you're not going to see these images anywhere else. But before we bring Paul into the show, of course, we'll introduce our co-host here, Maja Daou. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm doing good today, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good, and I want to thank you for you suggested Paul as a guest, and I've been incredibly enjoying his website, and it's such a fascinating topic, and I have no doubt that you have something to say about the the pleasure and fascination of human bones.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, I was very fortunate to be able to meet Paul through some mutual friends. And, I mean, I've been doing this lecture series about death and just really examining how we separate ourselves from death in this culture. So to see Paul's book, which is about, you know, getting face-to-face with the bones and experiencing the bones and death, not out of fear, but as a way to remind ourselves of our immortality, because that's kind of really how I think. And I mean, in yogi philosophies and meditation from different places around the world, one of the first things they teach you is to think about your bones. So the importance of bones is no small thing. So I'm always down with anyone who's into the bones.
All right. Well, let's bring on Dr. Bones. hey, Paul, thanks for being with us here on Expanding Mind.
I have such a pleasure to be with you, and I so appreciate your introduction because it's so appropriate. When I talked to Maja originally, when, as she said, we met through mutual friends, you know, one of the things I pointed out was that ostensibly my book is an illustrated history of these sites, but it functions as something more as well. I wanted it to reveal what I call the dialogue with death, this idea that in our culture, as Maja reference, you know, we've taken the dead and kind of ghettoized them. There's this kind of border between us and them, and it's impassable. But cross-culturally and throughout history, that's not been the way it was. Death was a transition. It was not a terminus. And it was possible to have this dialogue, and it doesn't mean it's a conversant dialogue, but it could be a symbolic dialogue. But somehow through that dialogue, and it's a dialogue, not a monologue, the dead are still allowed to play an important part in spiritual or cultural life. And what you said about the bones and this kind of mystical quality of being among them, people often ask me, you know, what's the sensation after 5 years? You know, when you're alone, as I usually was in some of these seldom visited bone rooms, what's the real sensation? And I always say that it's one of timelessness or connectivity, you know, this idea that I am standing in the present and I'm staring in the past and I'm contemplating the future because it's my future, you know, and it was this feeling that whatever you believe, there's something that we're all connected to and that we're all a part of, and I found that to be a profound experience.
Yeah, the time trip part of it, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, again, even in this experience that I had, I mean, I you know, we all were, you know, boisterous and goofy and drunk, and we went in there, and then everyone got kind of quiet, but not in a spooked out way, just in a kind of wow, we're in the presence of something here. And we just kind of sat there, didn't talk very much, just kind of took it in. But what happened to me was I immediately felt what you call them, you know, sort of ghosts, not in the sort of, you know, paranormal sense, but I was suddenly aware of time. This was a butcher. All of these people had sex. All of these people were sick. They had children. They got, you know, whatever. And then, like, and so it was the sense of the past, and then the strong sense of my present. But then, like you say, it also gestures forward in this way that's weirdly comforting, even as it's, because it's like, oh, I'm not really alone. I mean, well, I'm just going to do what everybody's going to do.
I think that, oh, dear, we're breaking up already. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think that you and I are talking about the same thing, just in different terms. I mean, when you're saying that it's comforting, I mean, I'm saying that I felt a sense of connectivity, which was a kind of comfort. And time, as you suggest, time just seems to collapse, them and us. We just kind of become one.
Well,
yeah.
And it's interesting, something I always like to say, just in talking about confrontation with the future, is as someone that does divination, if you look at the history of most divination systems, the original ones and some of the stronger ones were bone oracle consultations, right? Mm-hmm. The way that they would actually predict and divine the future was through reading bones, which are, I mean, it's funny because it is everybody's future and everything, right? They would do animal bones, I Ching was about turtle bones.
Yeah.
The bones actually do reveal this timeline, and it's no joke that our entire DNA history is contained in the mitochondrial DNA, which they extract from our bones. So saying that bones contain the future and the past is actually even scientifically true. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Right, the phrase rolling the bones, it's more than, it's a metaphor for much more than throwing dice.
Yeah.
It's not random. Typically, in my research, and my research was confined mostly to Christian sites around the 16th and 17th centuries, but it becomes something larger, and it becomes something I think that's quite universal. The presence of bones, especially large amounts of bones, has always marked a kind of liminal space. And within that space, it's possible to transcend and contact.
Well, and part of one of the things that I really like in your intro to the book that you talk about is that it's a dialogue with death, and you mentioned that briefly. And just as part of going into that liminal space and the dialogue, I mean, the first thing I thought about was like Hamlet, you know, in that scene where he's confronting the skull and kind of he's talking to the skull and having a dialogue with it. And I mean, we just don't do that in our society. First of all, we don't face death at all, so nobody likes to look at bones or even, you know, confront that situation. But when you say, like, can you talk a little bit about that dialogue that happens when you're with the bones? I mean, I think the closest any of us here in the West get to that is watching elephants do it on, like, the nature shows. But we don't even show pictures of people, like, having dialogues with skeletons. So what kind of dialogue are you kind of talking about that can take place in that liminal space?
Well, again, it depends on the person, and it depends on their belief, because sometimes it's a conversant dialogue and sometimes it's strictly a symbolic dialogue. But one of the things that was wonderful to me in doing this research is finding places where that does still exist, because as I think we're all in agreement, that's kind of been cut out of Western culture. The dead have become abject and they've become ghettoized. And as I try to point out in the introduction, you know, there's this real falsehood when we confront death now, because the dead are asked to play one last act as the living. You know, we dress them up as if they were still alive and make them up and ask them to pretend that they're alive for one more day. And then we put them away and that's the end of them. You know, we don't want to deal with them again beyond that, because we really don't want to deal with the reality of death. I had found many times, I remember this instance when I was in Milan photographing a wonderful bone chapel there, San Bernardino Alayosa, or Little St. Bernard's of the Bones. When I would photograph there, there was this one old lady, and she was very old, and she would come in every day to talk to the bones, and she would always glare at me. You know, I felt so horrible because I was contaminating her sacred space by taking my photos. But it was also so wonderful to see this person who was still part of this dialogue, and she would come in and pray to them, and just in the way that people had 300 years ago, and ask them to be intercessors. You know, and it is a dialogue, because she speaks to them, but they provide something back. You know, in her case, again, it depends on your belief system. In her case, those bones are the bones of the souls in purgatory, and her prayers are meant to ameliorate their suffering in purgatory. But then at the same time, that dialogue, what comes back to her, are those souls acting as intercessors for her. And it's, you know, I was fortunate enough to visit many places where that dialogue does still continue, where it has not been fully contaminated. One of them is in Bolivia. Every November 8th, there's this marvelous fiesta called the Fiesta de las Nietitas. And Nietitas means the little pug-nosed ones, but they're referring to skulls. And these skulls they live in people's homes with them year-round in little shrines, and they act as intercessors, and they leave offerings for them, they speak to them, and these skulls provide services for them. And every November 8th, they come back to the cemetery for this marvelous celebration that's unlike anything in the world. It's like the Dia de los Muertos, but it's real, because, you know, 20, 30,000 people come down to the cemetery with these skulls in their shrines, and they hold this gigantic, elaborate party for them with traveling musicians playing to edify the skulls, and this is a means of showing respect to the dead, but not just venerating the dead, but thanking them for what they provide, because the dead are still a very much part of these people's lives. And this is a very pervasive belief system. I went to visit the police in La Paz, because in the homicide division of La Paz, they have two of these skulls named Juanito and Juanita, and I was able to talk to detectives and interview these detectives about how they consult the skulls and sit there and get videotape of police getting down on their knees and speaking to Juanito and asking this skull, saying, you know, we need a clue in this case, you know, you're dead, you're beyond us, you have this vision, please help us solve this murder.
Yeah,
wow.
It's funny how in I was just reflecting on, again, our experience, or, you know, as an American, you know, the only place we really do this is that we do it through, you know, the kind of manufactured fantasies of entertainment. And when I was a kid in particular, I mean, of course, there's all the films and, you know, Skeletons Come to Life and, you know, Harry Harryhausen and all that kind of stuff. But the one that really was impactful for me when I was a kid was the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disneyland, which once you figure it out, is actually a story told backwards. So it begins with like the skeletal remains of these characters that you're going to see kind of in this weird. So it's a weirdly Bardo like. You know, experience for being like a pop ride, and I can remember just the feeling of the skeletons in the sense of a speaking skeleton or whatever. But it's so fascinating that we can't stop doing it. It's always going to be part of human culture, but it's just it's so hidden. And I mean, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was a lot of these places, and just looking at your website, because I haven't seen your book yet, but even your website. You know, very beautiful, and you include a lot of photographs, so it's a generous website, that you talk about a lot of these sites they're just not really known, you know, and the tourist boards are kind of weird about them, they don't really want people to know, and what is that about, even? Like, even with the beauty and the architecture and the arrangements of so many of these places, they're still kind of, you know, there's a sense about them being kind of off ground, so what's up with that?
Yeah, there continues to this day, and it's something that started in the 19th century when a lot of the old charnel houses started to disappear. They were allowed to deteriorate, or they were just demolished. With the advent of modernism came a sense that these places represented something superstitious and archaic, and something that was perhaps sinister in nature, and something that did not reflect the modern individual the way he wanted to be seen. And it's such a misinterpretation of them. You know, one of the first and the most famous of the really glorious ones is Santa Maria della Concezione in Rome. It's the one, quite famous, it's the one in Rome where they combine the mummies of the monks with this wonderful architecture and human bone. And the actual patron for that place, who paid for it, was Pope Urban VIII. So there's nothing sinister about these places. You know, this was Catholicism at its finest. This was stock, standard Catholicism to show this kind of penitence at the time. There was nothing morbid about it. There was nothing sinister. There was nothing strange. There was nothing deviant. This was fit for a pope, and the guy who designed it was the pope's own cousin. So this was standard stuff. It was only in the modern era that these started to be interpreted as something strange or sinister or somehow perverse, and so there is this reluctance now, as you point out. There is this reluctance, aside from the ones which you mentioned, like the one in the Czech Republic, the famous Bone Church and the Paris Catacombs, aside from the ones that have become tourist destinations based only on shock value, which is not their real value, because the real value is spiritual, the rest of them, especially the ones that are still in ecclesiastic hands, they're considered somehow shameful. They're considered somehow, these archaic superstitious gestures, which a lot of even these churches don't want to be known for anymore. There's one in Portugal, which is an extraordinary place just in terms of what befell it. It's in Lagos, Portugal, a small port town on the southern Portuguese coast. It's kind of a tourist destination, and no one knows it's there because the church itself is kind of so ashamed of this little bone chapel that they turned it into the gardener's tool shed. And I call it the world's most macabre tool shed because the gardener's got his rakes and his fertilizer and all this stuff stored in this small closet-sized chapel filled with human bones.
Whoa.
Amazing.
Well, in your research, what do you think it is that separates us and makes us turn those things that way? Are there any like ossuaries in the United States?
It's funny you ask that question because as I was at the very end of my research, the very tail part of it, I got this report about someone finding a charnel house under a church in Boston, and it wasn't one of these elaborately decorated ones because the people in Boston back in the day weren't Catholics, and you had to be a Catholic to really want to create a flamboyant display. It's kind of a counter-reformation thing. But I got this report of someone discovering this old charnel house in Boston, because before then, the only one I knew of that had ever been in the United States was a small one that was outlined in a very old map of the Spanish settlement in St. Augustine, Florida, and that was long gone. And so I tried very hard to contact this church in Boston, saying, you know, I'm doing this book, you know, it's about to be published, we're doing the final layout, can I please come to Boston and take a look at this thing and get photos? And they would not return my phone calls. They would not return my emails or my phone calls. To this day, I have no idea what's in Boston. It's funny, you know, it's like I would contact Poland, I would contact monasteries in Greece, and they'd get back to me in 24 hours. Boston, forget it.
Huh.
How?
And I mean, that just says so much that, I mean, part of the whole idea that we see those things as morbid and we don't have any opportunity in America to have that experience, to go be with the bones. I mean, as you said, they're ghettoized, but what that literally means is they are removed from our ability to even access them. They're so inaccessible, you don't even get a phone call back. So it's almost like we have made death, or even investigating it, kind of out of our capacity to investigate.
It's kind of taboo, yeah.
Well, I want to ask you about that taboo, because, you know, the flip side, in a way, of this disavowal, of this kind of hiding, setting it aside, becomes a fascination that has an element of purience to it, or like almost an exaltation of the morbidity. You know,
yes.
We make it morbid by, you know, get it out of the way, and then there's this kind of fascination, like, wow, that's so cool, it's so weird, it's so screwed up, oh my God, you know. And that's an element of what's exciting about, like, looking at these photographs. Obviously, there's, like, you're sort of like, it's like a taboo, it's like the veil comes off of this repressed world, and there's a sense of sort of an illicit secret or whatever. And, you know, that's partly, you know, so a lot of people who buy your book are probably people who like bizarre stuff, who collect, you know, Joe Coleman paintings and things, whatever, you know, and you know, I love a lot of that art too, but there is a kind of element that's not quite really engaging with it as the kind of spiritual expression that it was designed to be, really without morbidity. I mean, maybe with some seriousness, but not exactly with that kind of bizarro factor. I'm curious, like, how did you go through a transformation as these things started to change for you, or how do you feel about that side of it, you know, as someone who's, like, putting these images out there, and, you know, people are going to like them for different reasons, but you must have thought about this.
Well, yeah, you're right on in what you say, Eric. And, you know, I think that sense that it's something that's repressed or hidden and now we get to see it, that does create a fascination, but it also creates kind of, at the same time, the wrong fascination, because it further removes us from the context. And in a sense, I think especially for American culture, it further provides a level of kitsch or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I pitched this book, I made a determined point to not pitch it to any American publishers. And it's not that I'm unpatriotic or something. It's just like I wanted to pitch it to European publishers, and it's published by Thames & Hudson out of London. They do have an office in New York, but I made sure to pitch it to the London office because I felt that since at least this is a part of European cultural history, they would have a little bit more sense of the spiritual value of it, because I was very afraid that if I got a book contract out of the United States, when it came to laying out the book and editorial, it, you know, they would look at it as something more like, you know, a giant Danzig belt buckle or something, you know, rather than a series of spiritual sites, which is not really, once I started dealing with the New York office, I found that, honestly, I was right, that the London office and the Europeans I had talked to had understood this better all along, at least in terms of this being a profoundly spiritual book. One of the, in my introduction, I cite an old architectural handbook that I had found, and this was an architectural handbook about civic planning. And one of the points that the authors make is that they thought in a fully healthy city, in an integrated, holistic city, that it was important to show visible reminders of death, because they cited psychological studies which they had found that said that people lived happier and more well-adjusted lives when they were confronted with reminders of death and reminders of their own mortality. And they felt that in a kind of utopian city, it was important to include reminders of death and mortality.
Well, and that's something that we had talked a little bit about, too, and you do mention in your intro that it's not just a reminder of your mortality, but what bones are is they are our immortal feature, which remains after we die. There is something that goes on forever. And
they
that
are our
is,
connectivity.
Yeah, exactly. And so these bones and looking at them is not only a reminder of an ending or a finality, like you said, but rather a transition and to look at things that endure after death has occurred, that there are these remnants of our existence that linger on, and it's important to be reminded of that as well.
Until us and until now, I think almost all cultures have had some element of that. If you go all the way back to the Neolithic period, like Neolithic Jericho, you know, there are records of people planting skulls that were decorated under their house. The Egyptians had, and I'm sure you're knowledgeable about this and probably much more so than I, but the Egyptians had what they called the ka, and that was the part of your soul that returned to this statue after you died, and it was a means of contacting you and allowing the soul who had passed on to have this connectivity with the mortal realm. And, you know, even into the fairly modern area, when I looked at the painted skulls, and I cover a lot of painted skulls in the Transalpine regions in the 19th century, when I looked at the skulls that were painted in the famous charnel house in Hallstatt, Austria, the elaborately painted ones on the forehead that they kept in the charnel house, I would find records and journal entries of people coming into the charnel house with their, say, grandfather, and their grandfather would point out skulls to them and say, you know, that's your great-grandfather Andreas, and, you know, and that is your great-uncle Thomas, and he was such a cut up, you know. It's like I remember when he set the teacher's shoe on fire in school, and they would tell them stories about these people in the presence of the bones, almost the way we now would use a family snapshot, you know, as an introduction to family history. The bones represented in that context, even up to, you know, 150 years ago, at least in these small rural parishes in Austria, the bones represented a family chain, and the bones of the ancestors represented a point of entree into family history, and they helped create connectivity with the generations that had passed, and apparently that was something that was possible to access through direct presence of the bone. They still held that trace, and you wanted to introduce people to family history in the presence of those bones, and it's part of the reasons that they were painted with the names painted on them, so they could point out to generations gone by, they could point out to these people and bring these people to life through presence of their death.
Mm. Wow. It's like a momentum worry squared. You know,
kind
it's like
of.
A reminder
kind of,
except, both ways, you know, about
exactly.
Both the individual and the collective aspect of it. I mean, that's one thing that deeper aesthetic and psycho-spiritual experiences I have in the presence of these places, especially ones where there's many, many, many skeletons represented and they're very aggressively recombined, so that there's no relationship anymore to, you know, a singular skeleton, is that there's this weird play between individuality and collectivity. Because you're looking at them and you're like, each one of these was an individual, just like me, like no one else ever before, ever since. And yet here in this sculpture, they are woven into a multiplicity that is really all of us. And that wavering between the two is extremely profound.
That's always been part of the function of the bone pile is anonymity. And that's part of its function as memento mori is to remind us that when we are disincorporated, when we are no longer corporeal, we become connected with everything. We become anonymous. We come from something that is anonymous, and we go back to something that is at least physically anonymous. But memento mori, I try to point out in the introduction that what we call memento mori back in the day was also memento vita. You know, it was also a reminder of life, that when we look at the bones, we are now reminded of death, but back in the day they were reminded of life. One of the famous phrases that they used to paint in the charnel houses, or they would inscribe this sometimes even on the skulls, is, you know, what you are, we once were, what we are, you will be. It doesn't just, that phrase is taken now as solely as a memento mori, but it also reminds us of life. It reminds us that we live to die, and they died from life. You know, they're connected, that by looking at death, we're not just reminded of death, we're reminded of life. And I think that in the civic, in the book on civic architecture that I mentioned in their psychological study, I think that was their point, that people will live better and well-adjusted when confronted with visible reminders of death, because in being confronted that way, they're also being confronted with visible reminders of life.
That's
and
great.
Life becomes more precious.
Yeah, this is a wonderful conversation. We got more questions to ask. We got to take a break here.
Yeah.
This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and we're talking about death and bones with Dr. Paul Koudenaris, author of The Empire of Death. And Paul, something I'm curious to get your opinion on that I think a lot about is not just that taboo of death in our culture, but also how it's kind of paraded as this threat and punishment, and kind of what differences you saw in presenting these ossuaries as a place where people can kind of hang out with the bones and convene with them, as opposed to how, like, bones are presented in our culture like a threat, like whether it's, you know, the skull and crossbones on a smoking package, or just even the, like, capital punishment, how treating death as a punishment to a crime kind of helps formulate our fear of it, and how we can, like, maybe try and rectify that in our culture.
Well, I don't know how we can rectify it in our culture, other than I think that our culture itself is already in the process of evolving in terms of its view of death, because as our culture, as Western or at least American culture, becomes more multicultural, especially as it absorbs, I think, more influence from Asian cultures. I think that our concept of death, which became very locked in after the Enlightenment, I think that is beginning to change, and we're beginning to look at whatever you want to call it, be it the soul or the spirit or some other more exotic term, we're looking at that as being more holistic with the physical body itself. One of the effects of the Enlightenment, and I think you can maybe trace this back especially to Descartes, you know, that the physical body and the spiritual body became kind of bifurcated, and that became something that was very typical of European culture and then was transposed onto the United States. And so when they became bifurcated, the act of dying, no longer having the physical body being able to respond, the act of dying became something in which the physical body, once it was vacated, the physical body was irrelevant, and the physical body became something that was abject, literally cast out. It became, you know, it became a detritus. And I think that's the point at which the idea of dying becomes especially frightful and especially threatening. People, you know, around this time of year now with this book out, people have been asking me to give a lot of Dia de los Muertos talks, which I appreciate the opportunity to, but I also try to point out, you know, just having death presented for Dia de los Muertos or Halloween or something, it also feeds into this idea that death is repressed, because death is only allowed to be exposed one day of the year. Mm-hmm. I like to say back in the period that I study, back in the medieval period and you know, the early modern period, every day was Dia de los Muertos. Anyway, so I think we're undergoing another evolution as we're beginning to reconcile the spiritual with the physical body.
Well, that's good. I like that. Optimistic.
Well, I think, I mean, you know, you're an expert in this area yourself. I mean, would you agree that as we absorb some of these more to Western culture exotic influences, they are slowly evolving our own thought process?
I hope so. I mean, I like to think that I see it happening, but I mean, I'm in Los Angeles, and I talk to a lot of people that are in other parts of the country where it's still pretty gnarly. I mean, people are just really not having a good time dealing with death, and it's still kind of thrown around as this huge punishment, and there's so much fear, and it's used as a fear by our government. And I mean, I'm a Sagittarius, so I'm eternally optimistic, so I'd like to think we're gonna pull out of it and pull through it, but I wish it was more evident. But I think your book is gonna help a lot of people.
I was I was reading in the research for this book, I came across the journal of this English sailor who had visited the Palermo catacombs in Sicily, and I always, if anyone asks me if there's one, you know, so-called macabre site I should visit, where should I go? And I always tell them the Palermo catacombs. It's incredible, it's bizarre, it's triumphant, and it's hilarious, and it's everything you could ever want. It's an incredible place. And it's a place in Palermo where people were mummified by the monks after they died, and then they would display them. And I think it's probably the largest extant collection of mummies in the world, and it's all people from a collection of a couple hundred years in Palermo. And I was reading this account of this English sailor who would talk about how he talked about how he had visited the Palermo catacombs, and people would come down, you know, in the 1700s and the early 1800s, they would come down into the catacombs, and they would stand there. They would have the monks mark out the niche on the wall where their mummy was going to be displayed, and they would stand there and like have them draw the outline of the person around them, and they would come down and visit while the stone carvers were cutting the niche out, and they would stand there. Like I said, they would stand there for hours motionless to kind of get a sense of what eternity would be like, to make sure their body fit properly in the niche. They would talk about, well, I don't want to be next to that guy's mummy because, you know, that guy has this bad reputation, and sometimes even fist fights would break out. It's like, because they were like, no, I'm not going to spend eternity next to that guy because he's got a bad reputation. He did so-and-so. And so I don't know that we can say that they were not afraid of death, because I don't think that they necessarily wanted to die and leave their loved ones in the life that they knew, much like we wouldn't. But at the same time, there was no reluctance towards facing it, and there was this real sense of its importance, and especially even the importance of the display of the physical body as a reminder to those who had lived. It was this real sense of, again, the word connectivity comes to mind, this real sense of connectivity with their mortality, and this acceptance of it, you know, this idea that they would just stand there motionless for hours, just letting their body get accustomed to the niche it was once going to be in.
That reminds me of a, you know, this is actually kind of a more, you know, optimistic spin on the way in which, you know, our culture is changing in relationship to death. Although it does not involve bones, because it's a columbarium, so it's a place where people inter ashes, and the whole idea of interring ashes itself is kind of an interesting thing which we can talk about. But what's really special is there's this one, it used to be in the old fellows, cemetery in San Francisco, and then when they took all the cemeteries out of San Francisco and put them down in Colma, they left the building, they left this columbarium. It became disused and then was sort of bought and refurbished by the Neptune Society in the 70s. And so part of it is like these old school, you know, turn of the last century, you know, columbarium niches with these just kind of like, faces and, you know, sort of old school stuff. And then for all the new ones, there's developed this remarkable culture, which I've seen a little bit in some columbaria in Los Angeles as well, but nothing off the scale of this marvelous place, where people will just sort of make little like dioramas, like little Cornell boxes, like these sort of memento art spaces where these ashes remain, and most of them are extremely life-affirming, and it's an incredibly optimistic place to go. So when anytime people come to San Francisco, it's like, well, I'm going to take you to my favorite place, and they're like, what, we're going to go there? It's going to be morbid. People are invariably like, I feel happy. You know, it's like there's something positive about seeing that kind of, you know, and some of them are religious, and some of them are secular, and some of them are silly, and some of them are sweet, and it's a really remarkable place. And then my wife liked it so much she got a niche there, and so now she's kind of like decorating her home. She's like, well, I want it to be kind of Victorian style, and I'm going to put this, these are going to be the walls, and da da da. It's like it's this sort of version of the practice that you were just describing, but in sort of a different way. I mean, probably because it doesn't involve the body in the same way. It's almost more of a kind of, you know, a mental operation. But I find it a very, very positive place, partly because it really expresses this healthy and very multicultural. It's like it's very multicultural. There's a lot of gay people. There's a lot of Asians, African-Americans. I mean, it's a very rich place that kind of, in a way, supports your argument that as we move into a more multicultural world, that American culture has a chance to develop a more healthy, creative, and even inspiring relationship with death.
Back in the day, especially in Italy, they had a social structure based on confraternities and guilds. And one of the most popular confraternities to be a member of was the Confraternity of Death. And every major city had them. In Rome, they had three different brotherhoods all dedicated to the idea of death. And ostensibly, their function was to provide a particular charitable service. And they would provide the charity of giving burials to people who died in poverty so that they could have a chance to have their body in sanctified ground, because if they didn't have enough money to be buried. But they also, as you suggest, it's another version of the same thing. They would also celebrate death. They would create huge public spectacles, and they wound up with a lot of bones, obviously, because they were providing burials for these people, and then they would have to dig them up after a certain point of time and store them in their headquarters or their charnel houses or their catacombs. And they would create these enormous public spectacles where they would, you know, maybe once or twice a year they would invite the entire city to come for this free show, where they would decorate things with the bones. They would have plays, and the entire decor would be made with the bones, or they would have parades. There is this, if you're familiar with Giorgio Vasari, who was the great biographer of the Italian Renaissance, he talks about the artist Piero di Cosimo and some decorations he had done for one of these parades, and it's stunning decor. I mean, it's too bad it's not in the Rose Parade, because Piero di Cosimo had arranged this gigantic train of death pulled by buffaloes, with these hatches that would open and skeletons would come out screaming pain, penance, and tears, and they would dance around. It's these huge public celebrations of death.
Wow. Well, you've had so many amazing adventures through the course of researching this book and going to these places. Was there one in particular that kind of struck you the most profoundly out of all the places you went?
As a site, I mean, the thing about the research for this book was, after, I could have written two books. The one I wrote may not have even have been the best book, because the other book that I didn't write, which I held back on out of just respect for the sites, was just the story of creating the book, because it was like the adventures of Baron Munchausen and Bones. There's one, my favorite guy, I had been photographing at a monastery that had a wonderful collection, a wonderful macabre collection. I'd been photographing at this monastery, and as I was finishing for the day, I photographed it for a couple days, as I was finishing on the first day, this monk who was kind of in charge of the crypt comes up to me. He's like, are you done? And I was like, yeah, I'm done for the day. I'm going to come back tomorrow. He's like, okay, well, let's go. Let's go to Sexy. And it's like, going to Sexy? That sounds a bit, what are we doing? And he puts on these jogging pants or whatever, street clothes, and takes me to this striptease club. And I'm kind of like, well, this is really, I really don't want to be in this striptease club with this monk. It's really uncomfortable for me. And so we're sitting at this table, and then he wandered off to go in some back room. I was like, I'm getting out of here. So I left him a note, Fra Donatello, I gotta go, I'll see you tomorrow. I had to go back to the hotel. So the next day he doesn't say anything, and we, at the end of the day, when I'd gone photographing, and he says to me again, he's like, come on, we're going to Sexy. I'm like, great, we're going back to Sexy again. So he takes me to the striptease club again, and he reaches under the table, and I felt something on my leg, and I look down under the table, and he has manacled my leg. He's taken handcuffs, and he's handcuffed me to the chair. And I kind of look at him, and it's like, what are you doing? And he kind of, now he smiles and he waves his finger at me. And he's like, it's like, yesterday you sneak off, today you're going to stay with me here at the club, eh? So, I mean, it's not a profound experience, but yeah, I certainly had, like I said, there was a second book I could have written, which would have been an extraordinary
one.
I had, I was getting driven around in Switzerland for a while by this priest who was a wonderful guy, and he had volunteered to drive me around to these different places I wanted to photograph, but he was obsessed with Frank Sinatra. He's this young Swiss priest who had this karaoke tape of My Way, and it would be like 4 hours at a time of driving back and forth with this priest who sang My Way repeatedly on a loop in the car. It nearly made me suicidal. I have never hated Frank Sinatra so much. And like I said, I couldn't write that book because I respect the sites too much to turn it into a comic book, and I wanted to maintain some semblance of order within the book. But yeah.
But that's an amazing part of the story, is just the real life of the people surrounding the places that are left, and the experience of the place too. And like Eric was saying, how his experience of it was, you know, through drunken malarkey with his friends, and just the absurdity of the experiences of going to these places, I think is an important part of including death in life, or the events and synchronicities that happen while we're, you know, at the places with real living people that are just doing their regular human being stuff, whether they're monks
Absolutely.
Or priests or whatever, you know?
Absolutely. There were so many different perspectives that I encountered, and so many different reactions, and so many different marvelous individuals. At Santa Maria della Concezione in Rome, which I already mentioned as being one of the real seminal kind of golden age of human decor and bone sites. There is an Italian lady who works at the front. It's part of a monastery still, but there's a lady who you know, sells the tickets and allows people admittance. And they had cleared out the place so I could take my photographs, and I was talking to the lady, and I said to her, do you like working here, you know, at Santa Maria della Concezione with all the bones? And she kind of thinks about it for a second, and she says to me, it's like, yeah, I like it here. I like the dead. They don't cause me any trouble. My husband, he causes me a lot of trouble. The dead, they cause me no trouble. I like working with the dead.
That's
so
amazing.
Good.
Now, what one site that Maja had mentioned is that, since I know you mostly went to Christian sites, you went to Ethiopia. Was that a Christian charnel house there?
Yeah. You know, people have this, I think, misunderstanding sometimes of Christianity as being a kind of European religion, and being a religion that's placed in European terms, and it's not. You know, it's a Middle Eastern religion. And the early history of Christianity is really, it's a Middle Eastern and North African history. And I had gone to Ethiopia. There are no photos of any of the Ethiopian places in the book, because this was before I'd actually started the book, but I had gone to Ethiopia once just to explore and to get a sense of the Ethiopian Christian rituals, because they're very old. Those might be the oldest preserved Christian rituals. Remember, the Ethiopian...
It's actually Armenia has the oldest one.
Okay, yeah, I believe that. But the Ethiopian ones are very, very old, you know, and they believe they have the Ark of the Covenant, and I was able to go and be part of that procession right before Orthodox Christmas, because they're Orthodox there. Right before Orthodox Christmas, I went to Aksum, and I was able to be part of the procession for the Ark of the Covenant. And they have a cave where very holy people go to die. It's near Lalibela, where they have those churches underground that are carved out of stone. And there's this cave where very old, very pious people go to die. When they're very old, they get on their hands and knees, and with whatever power they have left, they climb up the side of this mountain, they enter in this cave, and they just lay down to die. And there's a church in the cave, so it's very much a Christian site. It's an Orthodox Christian site, and it's very, very old. And there's a church carved out of stone in the cave, and I was walking around in this dark church. I had to take a guide with me to show me where this cave was. And I was walking around, and I was stepping on these twigs and pebbles, and I said to the guy, you know, it's like, because it was so dark in there you couldn't see, and I could hear these twigs breaking under my feet, and I said to the guy, can you show me where the bone field is and where the people go to die? And he just shines his flashlight down, and he's like, but we're in it. And what I thought were twigs and pebbles were just bones that I'd been walking on for 15 minutes.
Wow.
And I just looked down, and just like all the way to the back of the cave and all the way to the front, it was just this bone pile with these shrouds, because they were, you know, the bones were still covered in the shrouds that the people had been wearing when they passed away. It's an incredible place that is very little visited and very little known about. As I said, that particular form of Christian culture, that African form, it's something that's a throwback, and it's something that is not much recognized, I think.
Yeah, well, I was just curious because I love Ethiopian Orthodox imagery, the architecture, the paintings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like there's something... It combines familiarity and the exotic in a way. So when
yes.
I heard that there was also an ossuary there, I was like, wow.
Ethiopia is a magical place. I'm with you on that. It's the one country that I really felt I didn't get enough of.
There is.
Wow.
I always like to tell people too. The real name of Ethiopia comes from Aethiopia, and in Africa, the word Oph or Obia is serpent, and the literal translation of the name Ethiopia is giant fiery serpent. And it used to be known in the old times because they would have giant serpents there. And some people think that's where they get the term seraphim, too, which is like for...
Really?
Yeah, for angels,
yeah,
which actually is fiery serpent as well. So,
well, like I say, it's a magical place where I think pretty much anything can happen. I'll tell you this wonderful story if I can, but it's a short story. It's not totally related, but it's wonderful. I had been there's a town in Ethiopia where they have not jackals, larger than jackals. Hyenas come every night, and they come outside the walls of the town, and, you know, they make this noise, and they're dangerous animals. And so they've taken to abating them and appeasing them by giving them chicken, and so they feed them chicken. And I had gone out with this guy who feeds them chicken one day, and he says to me, "Would you like to feed the hyenas some chicken?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." He says, "Would you like to feed them chicken from your mouth?" I was like, "You got to be kidding." "Sure, why not?" I was like, "Okay." So I chewed this piece of chicken, and I walked up to a hyena, and I opened my mouth and stuck out my tongue. And this hyena looked at me like I'm kind of crazy and just took this piece of chicken out of my mouth and turned around and ran off. And I turned around, and the guy looked at me like, "Are you crazy? I was joking." He's like, I've been joking with people like that forever, and no one's ever actually done it. I was like, wow, Ethiopia really is a magic place. I should have had my head ripped off. Yeah, it's a magic place. I agree with you.
That's amazing. So what's next? Are you going to continue on this fascination, or, you know, it sounds like you're still pretty enthused?
Well, what's next for me right now? I'm still promoting the book. The book is just released. I'm in San Francisco right now to do some book talks. I'm doing one today at Paxton Gate, and then tonight at what's called Trickster Salon. I have one tomorrow in Berkeley at Dark Carnival, and then one Sunday at Dog-Eared Books. I'm doing a lecture at the Brand Library in Glendale on the 27th. And after that, after early November, no one really wants to talk to me about death anymore, because, you know, death is a 3-week holiday around Halloween and Dia de los Muertos for us, and then we go back to the act of living. And then I want to get back to particular research. In my book, I had mentioned very briefly this trend in the Bavarian region, 16th and 17th century, for taking these bodies from the Roman catacombs, which had been recently rediscovered then, and decorating them in jewels, and then displaying them in the churches in these glass cases as patrons of the church and patrons of the city. These are incredible works of art. There are photos of a few of them in my book, but I think that those skeletons, the most beautiful skeletons I've ever seen, completely jeweled, they deserve their own treatment. They deserve their own book. And so I want to get back to Germany in January or February and continue photographing those, because I would like to do a study that's primarily just a photographic study of those jeweled skeletons, because it's mind-boggling, the love and care that was given to those skeletons. They're just incredible.
Well, that's super great. I mean, I'm curious, though, did you always have this kind of interest, or was it just something you kind of stumbled in and was like, hey, no one's really dealing with this stuff, let's go? Like, does it make sense, like, you know, through your whole life you can see yourself building these projects, or did it kind of come out of nowhere?
Well, it's always a little bit of both. I mean, most things that you get involved with in life are accidental, I think, whether we realize it or not. There's a degree of happenstance. Obviously, I wouldn't have gotten into this if I had been repulsed by the macabre, but the actual genesis of the book was an accidental discovery when I had stumbled by happenstance into a charnel house in Melnik in the Czech Republic that nobody seemed to know about. And it's an amazing place, very erudite in its decor. And when I told people I had been to this charnel house in Melnik in the Czech Republic, everyone kept saying, no, you mean the one in Sedlik, which is near Kutná Hora, the one they call the Bone Church near Prague, the famous one. They're like, no, you were there. It's like, no, I wasn't there. I know that one. I was in Melnik, and they'd say, no, there's not one in Melnik. And I was so baffled at how no one, even in the Czech Republic, knew about this alternate site, which to me was just as impressive, that I wanted to find out how many more of these places there were. It started as a travelogue, and then it turned into an entire book. But so in that sense, it started, the genesis of it was something of an accident, but in a weird way, and this is true, my great-grandfather, lived in Alexandria, Egypt, as did my grandfather. My family were Greek, and they lived in Egypt. And my great-grandfather was actually a grave robber. He would break into cemeteries and steal recently deceased bodies and cover them in tar, take them out into the desert, and they'd bury them in the sand so they'd get real hot. And then they would sell them to apothecaries as mummies. And you know about the mumia trade. You know, that used to be a pharmaceutical. They would grind up mummy dust and snort it as some kind of cure-all. And so he was one of these guys who would make these fake mummies, because by that time there really weren't a lot of mummies you could get your hands on. So I don't know, you know, maybe it's something about my family, I don't know.
Well, that's a wonderful note to end on. We're gonna have to wrap it up. Paul, thank you so much for being on the show. Your book Empire of the Dead is great. People should check it
thank
out.
Thank you, Eric.
You can do it on the website.
Thank you, Maja.
All right, well, from Maja and me, keep your minds open.